This is Fresh Air. On this archive edition of our show, we're featuring interviews with black and white South Africans who opposed apartheid. White South African playwright Ethel Fugard has written plays about the emotional and psychological consequences of apartheid. As a playwright, actor, and director, Fugard defied his country's white supremacist system. When he co-starred in his 1961 play, The Blood Knot, with black actor Zakes Mokhai, they became the first black and white actors in South African history to share a stage. Soon after, Fugard was approached by a group of black actors seeking his help to start a company. Together they formed the Serpent Players. The company was frequently harassed by the authorities. A few members were imprisoned. Some of Fugard's best-known plays include Sizwe Bonswe is Dead and Master Harold and the Boys. In 1986, I asked him if there were any obstacles he faced when he started collaborating with black actor Zakes Mokhai.
Well, firstly, I mean, just for Zakes and myself to get together as two actors and to go up onto a stage, that had never happened before in South Africa, that a black man and a white man had appeared on a stage, and a black actor or a white actor had appeared on a stage at the same time. We were the first in that regard, and all sorts of complications were attendant on that. I mean, in travelling around the country when we eventually took Blood Knot to different cities, Zakes had to travel third class because he had no other choice. I travelled first class. Life was very complicated. Zakes, on a point of principle, refused to carry his reference book. He wanted to make a political statement in his personal life. I knew that if we didn't have that book around with us, that we'd be in trouble. Zakes would be in jail and the show couldn't go on. So I carried the book for Zakes, and whenever the police stopped us, I presented it and pretend that Zakes was working for me, things like that. Yes, there have been lots of complications along those lines. When I collaborated with John Carney and Winston and Chawner to produce Sizwe Bonzi is Dead and The Island, there again, officialdom just couldn't cope with black men as actors. There was no precedent for that. So, as far as the sort of paper bureaucracy of South Africa is concerned, John Carney and Winston Inchona worked for me. John was a clerical employee and Winston was my chauffeur. You know, it's the only way we could get away with it.
Did that affect the relationship that you had with each other, since when officials asked, you had to be in the superior employer relationship?
No, you're quite right. Well, no, you learned to play those games as part of your survival mechanism in South Africa. I mean, you know, many, many times, in order to bail Zakes and myself out of a tight spot, for example, with the police, I would put on a heavy Afrikaner act and talk to the policeman as if I was a good Afrikaner and Zakes was my boy, my employee. And Zakes knew that I was doing it in order to, to keep the two of us out of jail. It was a survival mechanism.
Is there a moment when you can point to and say, this is when I realized that the system of apartheid was evil, was unjust?
Yes. I mean, the moment of certainty, the moment when I realized the extent of what that system was doing, came when I, for a variety of reasons, took on a job in Johannesburg, which was to be the clerk of a court, of a criminal court that tried black people for offences in terms of the passbook that they are compelled by law to carry. And it's when I sat in that courtroom 5 days a week for a period of about 6 months and watched a black man or woman, and sometimes a child, being disposed of at the rate of one every 3 minutes, being sent off to jail. When I saw that tidal wave of humanity being processed by this diabolical machine, that the full extent of what apartheid meant and does and was doing dawned on me, when it was brought home to me.
Playwright Athel Fugard recorded in 1986. Poet Dennis Brutus will tell us about his imprisonment after this break. This is Fresh Air. Exiled black South African poet Dennis Brutus barely survived his imprisonment for anti-apartheid activities. Brutus helped lead the movement to expel South Africa from the Olympics. The South African government retaliated by firing him from his job teaching high school English and banning him from participating in any political or social activities. In 1963, Brutus was arrested for breaking the ban. He was shot and nearly killed when he tried to escape. Brutus was patched up to face 18 months of hard labor in South Africa's most brutal prison, Robben Island. That was followed by a sentence of 5 years under house arrest. After 1 year of this house arrest, he signed an exit permit, which allowed him to leave the country, but promised his immediate imprisonment if he ever returned. He emigrated to the United States in 1970. I spoke with Brutus in 1986. He told me that when he started opposing apartheid, he discussed the risks he was taking with his wife.
We talked it through all the way to the point where I said to her that sooner or later I will go to prison, that you can continue opposing for so long, and they will apply various pressures. The ultimate pressure would be imprisonment, and we agreed that I would take that risk as well. The curious thing was that I assured her that if I was in prison, one other possibility still existed, that I might be found dead, and there would be a report that I had been killed trying to escape, and if she ever heard that, she should refuse to believe it, and she should insist on an investigation, because I would not do this if I was in prison. The irony here is that eventually I did precisely what I said I would not do when I was shot in the back by the secret police attempting to escape, and I had, in fact, been attempting to escape. So when she saw me in hospital, she reproached me and said, you had told me you would never do this, you know, what happened? But I think the circumstances justified it. I had escaped from South Africa. I was then on bail, facing a charge for attending a meeting of the South African Olympic Committee. And I got to Mozambique, which was then a Portuguese colony, and the Portuguese returned me to South Africa. But no one knew that I had been returned, and everybody assumed that I had succeeded in escaping. And the only way to make them aware that I had failed was to attempt another escape in a public place and risk being shot, since they were both armed. They had armpit holsters with guns. But I decided the only way to make people aware that I was in fact back in Johannesburg, while they were under the impression that I was outside the country, was to attempt another escape.
And you were shot in the back at very close range.
Well, close enough for the bullet to go clear through me. It entered my back and came out of my chest and had penetrated the intestines and just missed the heart. It was pretty serious. I wasn't sure I was going to survive. I remember the man who shot me, Sergeant Helberg, saying to me, as I lay on the sidewalk on the main street in Johannesburg, just outside the Anglo-American Corporation, which is the great mining conglomerate. And I lay on the sidewalk, and Sergeant Helberg said to me, anyway, Brutus, I hope you survive. And I said, well, I hope so too. And in fact, I was taken to hospital and then operated on after that.
It's almost surprising that you were given good enough medical treatment to survive after that.
Yes. In fact, it's just possible that they lost control of the situation at that time and so settled into the normal routine. Here is a man who was shot. You take him to hospital. You operate on him. And that's it. You know, you try and save his life. There were some complications. The ambulance that came for me, for instance, this was so macabre. The men got out in uniform and they took out a stretcher and they looked at me. And they put their stretcher back and they got back in the ambulance and they drove off. And I said to Hellberg, who was beside me, why are they leaving? I was very alarmed. And he said, well, Brutus, you wouldn't want them to lose their job, would you? This is an ambulance for whites, and so you'll have to wait for the black ambulance to come along. And then when it did come, six members of the police got into the ambulance with me and sat there with notebooks poised and started questioning me about people that they should contact on my behalf. But clearly this was in an effort to get leads. And then perhaps the most Kafkaesque part of it was when the doctors started operating, the police insisted on being in the operating theater. And the doctors protested and said, well, look, you're covered with germs, you've got to be sterile, we can't have you here. So they said, well, hold it. And they went off and came back, all masked and in gloves and covered boots and whatnot, and they stood there at the table. And the doctors then said, well, we can't work with you standing around us. It's impossible. And they refused to leave. And so I sat up and said that I think these men are hoping to get a statement out of me, perhaps under anesthetic. So perhaps I should make a statement now, and then they would leave you to get on with the work. So they agreed, and they took out their notebooks. And I said, well, I regret nothing. I would do this again if necessary, because I think this is an unjust system, and that's all I intend to say. And then they withdrew to the doorway of the theater and stood there, but I think they gave up at that point.
You were later taken to Robben Island, which is considered the most hellish of all the prisons in South Africa, and it's supposedly unescapable. It's supposed to be escape-proof.
Yes, well, no one has ever escaped. That's true. Those who managed to get off the island were usually found dead. Their corpses would be washed up on the beach of Cape Town subsequently. No one, as far as I know, has succeeded in escaping and living. And, of course, I spent time there with people like Nelson Mandela, Walter Sisulu, Governor Mbeki, and Ahmed Kathrada. We broke stones together. We were given rocks every day and a hammer, and we broke rocks.
Could you describe the prison a little bit and why it is so unescapable?
Well, it's heavily guarded, heavily fortified. The wardens were all white. The prisoners are all black. Automatic rifles. There's barbed wire. There's sentry posts. There are helicopters which circle the island. And in fact, when I got there, I was part of a span, as it's called, or a team, that had to carry rocks out of the sea and up the beach to build a wall around the island. And in fact, one of my poems deals with that, because I was so covered with bruises, and I was beaten while I was working, that I became a kind of a spectacle. And every evening when we stripped, we were required to stand naked outside the cells and be searched. The wardens would come along and inspect my bruises, and I felt a little like a freak in the circus, a two-headed calf or a bearded lady or a tattooed lady, as I called it. So perhaps I should just read it at this point. For a while I was the tattooed lady of the prison, and wardens would come to our section and get me to strip and stare and whistle in mingled pleasure and horror at the great purple bruise that ran from my neck down my back, from my neck to my thighs in a purple mass. What was I then? Mute, enduring reproach, heroic endurer, Christianly hero, or submissive fool? What was I then that I cannot now imagine, cannot now judge?
Did you consider the beatings that you were subjected to and the hard labor as well a form of torture of political prisoners?
I think so. Although it was so random and unsystematic, they just decided to teach us that Robben Island was really Hell Island, and so they beat us at the slightest provocation, and very often without provocation. It was really an attempt to demoralize us. And they saw political prisoners as far more dangerous than murderers or rapists or anybody else. And so it was important for them to humiliate us because they saw us as a threat to the system.
Robben Island had a mix of political prisoners like yourself and people who were there on criminal offenses. Did you mix it all, and was there any attempt to politicize the criminals?
There were, when I arrived there, I became one of 1,100 political prisoners. And in addition, we had 200 who were there for multiple murders, multiple rapes. The government described them as the scum of the prison system or the dregs of the prison system. They were the worst in the country. And these 200 were then put in charge of the political prisoners. They took us to work, they gave us our food, they beat us up. So mix is probably not the right word. Certainly we were together, but they were dominant over us on behalf of the guards. So the guards, in fact, simply gave the orders, but these orders were carried out, and the supervision was by what were called often blow bikies, and that's translated as blue jackets. And they were lifers, people who would never come out of prison and who therefore wore a different uniform. They wore little blue jackets. And they were rather proud of their status. And they also, of course, collaborated with the wardens in beating us up and would then be rewarded for having performed these duties. Often they ate our food as well. They were due to deliver it to us in our cells each evening. But if they chose to, of course, we went without it.
South African poet Dennis Brutus recorded in 1986. This is Fresh Air.